May 31st, 1975, Hamilton, New Zealand. 18-year-old Mona Blades leaves to hitchhike hundreds of kilometers in order to attend her nephew's birthday party, but she never arrives. After Mona is reported missing, witnesses would recall seeing her inside an orange Datsun station wagon with an unidentified man. Over the years, investigators examined a number of different suspects, including a former traffic officer, a man who committed suicide only weeks after Mona went missing, and a biker gang, but no trace of Mona is ever found. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today, for the first time ever, our podcast is going to be traveling down under to New Zealand to chronicle one of the most famous unsolved cold cases in the history of that country, the 1975 disappearance of Mona Blades. That voice you just heard narrate our intro is Lo Quinn Britton, the most recent winner of our Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest. And she did an awesome job, so thank you very much, Lo Quinn. If you would like to enter this contest and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions at the end of this episode. Anyway, even though The Trail Went Cold is closing in on its 3-year anniversary, we have yet to tackle a mystery from New Zealand, even though we definitely have a fan base there. I took the initiative to do this after recently receiving an email from a New Zealand listener named Jade, who suggested a number of intriguing Kiwi cases to feature on the podcast, so I definitely think this is long overdue. I decided to cover the disappearance of an 18-year-old woman named Mona Blades, who has been missing for over 43 years. Mona vanished after embarking on a lengthy hitchhiking trip to visit her family, as this was an era when hitchhiking was much more common practice. What's particularly interesting about this case is that Mona was last seen inside an orange Datsun station wagon, which has been the primary lead for the past 4 decades. However, a recent TV special has suggested that this lead may have been faulty and steered the investigation in the wrong direction. Her disappearance is now being looked at from an entirely different angle, so we're going to explore all these angles on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the disappearance of Mona Blades. Our story begins in New Zealand in 1975. Our central figure is 18-year-old Mona Blades, who is currently living in the city of Hamilton alongside her sister Lillian, her brother-in-law Tom, and her baby niece. Mona has been working as a shop assistant, but is planning to start a new job at a dairy. On Saturday, May 31st, Mona made a last-minute, spur-of-the-moment decision and decided that she wanted to make a trip to the city of Hastings to see the rest of her family. One of New Zealand's national holidays is the Queen's Birthday, which takes place every year on the first Monday of June, and Mona was hoping to spend the long weekend attending her nephew's first birthday. She had bought him a set of colorful plastic tumblers as a birthday gift, and since she was hoping to surprise everyone, Mona did not tell her family that she was coming. However, the distance from Hamilton to Hastings was over 300 kilometers, and the trip would take nearly 4 hours. Since Mona did not own a vehicle, and her sister and brother-in-law were unable to drive her, she would have to hitchhike her way there. So early Saturday morning, Tom drove Mona to State Highway 1 and dropped her off there so she could hitchhike a ride and begin her trip. But Mona never arrived in Hastings that day, and since she wanted her appearance to be a surprise, and her family did not know she was coming, they did not realize anything was amiss. After 3 days, Mona's sister and brother-in-law realized she had not arrived back in Hamilton, and when she missed the first day of her new job at the dairy without contacting anyone, her family became concerned and reported her missing. Mona's disappearance would eventually become one of the largest missing persons investigations in the history of New Zealand, and it wasn't long before eyewitness sightings of Mona began pouring in. A female motorist came forward who believed she had picked up Mona hitchhiking and given her a ride to the town of Taupā, which was located about 150 kilometers away from Hamilton and was the approximate halfway point of her trip to Hastings. She remembered dropping Mona off at the town's information center, and the attendant would recall speaking with a young woman matching her description who said she was traveling to Hastings in order to visit her parents. Police also heard from a truck driver who claimed that sometime after 10 a.m. that morning, he saw Mona climbing into an orange Datsun 120Y station wagon on the outskirts of Taupā. The driver was able to follow the Datsun for a little while, but eventually lost the vehicle in heavy holiday traffic. But investigators would hear of another intriguing lead involving this particular vehicle. Sometime later that morning, a fencing contractor was driving on Matea Road, a dirt road located next to State Highway 5, over 50 kilometers southeast of Taupā. The contractor was about 200 meters from the highway when he passed by an orange Datsun station wagon parked by the side of the road. He remembered seeing a young woman matching Mona's description in the back seat, and a large, balding, middle-aged man was behind the wheel. A short time later, the contractor drove by the spot again from the opposite direction and said that the orange Datsun was still parked there, but this time, it was empty. State Highway 5 was the route one would take in order to travel from Taupā to Hastings, and other witnesses would recall seeing a Datsun veering off the highway and driving down Matea Road. A month and a half later, police would receive an anonymous letter from a woman who claimed that she had been hitchhiking on that same highway on May 31st and was picked up by a middle-aged man driving an orange Datsun station wagon who said he was heading towards the city of Napier, which is only 20 kilometers outside of Hastings. His behavior made her uncomfortable, so she told him to pull over and let her out. The woman then said she was picked up by an elderly couple, and they eventually passed by the same orange Datsun parked by the side of the road. She caught a glimpse of the license plate, and while she couldn't provide a full number, she remembered that it started with the letter H, ended with the number 4, and the second letter might have been a K, B, or E. She said the reason she had sent the letter anonymously was because her parents didn't want her to get involved. Even though police sent out a public plea for the writer to come forward and provide more information, she never did. An extensive search effort was performed with the Matea Road area where all these sightings had taken place, but they turned up no trace of Mona or the backpack she had been carrying that day. However, immediately after police went public about the sightings of the orange Datsun station wagon, a strange incident took place. On the very same day the announcement was made, a man named John Freeman shot and wounded a student at St. Cuthbert's College in Auckland before turning the gun on himself and committing suicide. This event took on a greater significance once it was discovered that Freeman had rented an orange Datsun station wagon on the very same weekend Mona went missing. In spite of this connection, no evidence could be found to link Freeman to her disappearance. Virtually every individual in New Zealand who owned an orange Datsun at that time were interviewed by police, and nearly all of them were able to provide alibis for May 31st. However, a man named Charlie Hughes had a difficult time accounting for his whereabouts that weekend. Hughes lived in Hamilton, worked for a house removal company, and drove an orange Datsun as his company vehicle. There were also sufficient kilometers on his odometer to cover a trip from Hamilton to Napier and back. While there was no direct evidence to implicate Hughes, he never went off the radar as a suspect. In 2005, on the 30th anniversary of Mona's disappearance, Hughes, who was living in Australia by this point, was re-interviewed by police and he voluntarily submitted a DNA sample. He also did not hesitate to publicly express his frustration about being considered a suspect for the past 3 decades, claiming that it had ruined his life. In addition to Hughes, police also said that another man who owned an orange Datsun in 1975 was being looked at as a possible suspect, though he has never been publicly named. Around the same time period, police received a promising lead when they learned that Mona Blades' name had been inscribed on some concrete inside a garage in the town of Huntley, leading to speculation that her remains might be buried under there. But this turned out to be a dead end, as the former owner of the property had inscribed Mona's name there 6 years earlier, and he apologized to the Blades family. But this would not be the only allegation about Mona's remains being buried under a concrete floor. In January of 2012, an excavation was done at a house in the town of Cowro, which had previously belonged to a former traffic officer named Mervyn Derek Hinton. Hinton had died nearly 4 years earlier, and a former police sergeant named Tony Moeller suspected he was responsible for Mona Blades' disappearance. Hinton and Moeller had served on the force together for a decade, and even though the two men were once close friends, Moeller was now convinced that Mona's remains were buried underneath the concrete laundry room floor of Hinton's former home. Moeller had spent years compiling evidence against Hinton and turned it over to the police, which compelled them to perform the dig. Apparently, when Hinton was questioned at the time Mona's disappearance took place, he said, quote, "If you think I did it, prove it." Moeller said that Hinton owned an orange Datsun in 1975, but this was disputed by Hinton's daughter, Pauline Barrett, who claimed her father was actually driving an orange Toyota Corolla station wagon at that time. Pauline also maintained that the concrete laundry room floor had been poured before Mona even went missing. While the excavation turned up nothing, though Moeller continues to maintain that Hinton was responsible and that Mona's remains might be buried on another section of the property. Pauline, who happens to be an attorney, has always maintained that her father is innocent, and even gone so far as to threaten Moeller with legal action over his accusations. The next development in this case took place just this past year in July of 2018, when Mona's story was featured on the New Zealand TV program Cold Case. Some veteran detectives had revisited the original case files in order to look at the disappearance with some fresh eyes, and they arrived at the conclusion that the biggest lead, the orange Datsun station wagon, may have completely hampered the investigation and caused the police to overlook other potential leads. Here are some of the issues they had. For starters, it turned out that the truck driver who saw Mona climbing into the Datsun changed details of his story each time he was interviewed by police, so it's possible his story may have been influenced by what he read or heard about the case. But the biggest issue was that the photograph of Mona, which was circulated by police and displayed by the media, was outdated. The photo was taken while Mona was a bridesmaid at a wedding, and she had long hair and blonde curls. However, at the time she went missing, Mona was actually sporting a shorter, mullet-style haircut. This means that some of the eyewitnesses who reported seeing Mona that day, including the truck driver, were basing their memories off a photo in which she had a completely different hairstyle. So if they remembered seeing a young blonde woman with long hair, they may not have actually seen Mona. The Cold Case program actually presented a new computer-generated composite of Mona with her shorter haircut, which they believed was a more accurate depiction of what she looked like on May 31, 1975. It also turned out that there were other eyewitness sightings of Mona in Taupo that day, which were not fully investigated. At around 10:30 a.m., a witness working in a fruit shop who happened to know Mona personally claimed that he saw her walking by with another female hitchhiker, and they both climbed into a darkish blue-green station wagon. There would also be 3 independent eyewitness sightings of Mona in town at the Spa Hotel, which took place between noon and 1:30 p.m. The first 2 witnesses saw Mona drinking with another young woman. The 3rd witness did not see the other woman, but claimed that he spoke to Mona and that she identified herself by name before she climbed into a red Toyota station wagon. There were also 2 more interesting eyewitness sightings of that red Toyota station wagon in Taupo that day. One witness saw the vehicle traveling in convoy with a biker gang at a service station, and later that evening, Another witness claimed she saw two men carrying a rolled carpet and placing it into the back of the Toyota. But after the sightings of Mona inside the orange Datsun entered the investigation, these leads were not followed up on. Investigators have revealed that they now have a new theory. Mona may have fallen victim to a biker gang. Mona apparently had affiliations with biker gangs from Hamilton and Auckland, and one of these gangs may have been traveling through Taupo on their way to a convention in Wellington that weekend. Shortly after the cold case program aired, an anonymous witness came forward to the Rotorua Daily Post newspaper and shared his belief that Mona had been murdered by members of the notorious Highway 61 Motorcycle Club. The witness shared a second-hand account from a deceased friend of his who claimed that in 1976, he had been with members of the Highway 61 gang inside a flat in Auckland and heard them talk about killing Mona Blades. However, the witness initially did not take this information seriously, since he was always under the impression that Mona was murdered by the man driving the orange Datsun. But once the cold case program essentially debunked this theory, the witness figured that his friend's story might have more credence. Investigators now believe that Mona did not leave Taupo alive on the day she disappeared, but thus far, she continues to remain a missing person, and there's still no answers about what actually happened to her. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So even though this is not a particularly well-known case in North America, it is one of the most famous unsolved mysteries in the history of New Zealand, and it's not hard to imagine why. Even though hitchhiking is considered a dangerous activity today, it's often surprising to go back a few decades and see just how many unsolved cases there are where a victim was murdered or went missing after they were last seen hitchhiking. But back then, it was just a more commonly accepted practice, and stories like this are the reason people are now so averse to it. In Mona's case, it sounds like she pretty much made a spontaneous decision to take a nearly 4-hour road trip to surprise her family, but given that her sister and brother-in-law had an infant daughter to take care of at that time, you can understand why they wouldn't have been able to drive her. I guess one of the most unfortunate aspects of this story is that because Mona wanted to surprise her nephew for his first birthday, it was days before anyone noticed she was missing. So whoever was responsible for her disappearance had ample time to cover their tracks. I certainly can't fault the diligence of the original investigators, as once Mona was reported missing, they went all out trying to find her. It's quite amazing that they checked out virtually every person in New Zealand who owned an orange Datsun station wagon, but herein lies the problem. What if that Datsun was nothing more than a red, or should I say orange, herring? It seems like investigators who have looked at this case today now lean towards this vehicle having no relevance to the case. And that would be incredible, considering that the orange Datsun has always been the number one clue associated with this case. If you want to use an analogy from a North American cold case, it's kind of like the Polaroid of the two bound children that were found after Tara Calico went missing. That photo has always been associated with Tara's case, but as the years have gone by, it seems more and more likely that the photo was just a red herring and has no connection to her disappearance at all. It would be tragic if so much focus on that orange Datsun prevented investigators from pursuing more promising leads. But we'll talk about this in more detail in a little while. For starters, let's discuss some of the people who have been named as potential suspects. The first major suspect who popped up on the radar was John Freeman, and it's not hard to see why. He rented an orange Datsun on the same weekend Mona went missing, and on the very same day police announced they were looking for a vehicle like that, Freeman shot and wounded a college student before committing suicide. That might sound pretty damning on the surface, and I wish I could do a more in-depth exploration into Freeman, but unfortunately, there just isn't that much information available about him. It's certainly easy to believe that he would be capable of harming Mona, but it's also possible that the timing of the shooting was nothing more than a complete coincidence. It's not clear if Freeman had already shown up on the radar as a suspect before the shooting occurred, or if they just connected him with the Datsun after he was already dead. If Freeman hadn't been investigated by police beforehand, it is strange that the announcement about the Datsun would be enough to cause him to snap and commit an attempted murder before shooting himself, especially since he just rented the Datsun and did not even own it. After all, a lot of people drove orange Datsun station wagons at that time, so renting one is not conclusive evidence that he killed Mona. There are too many key pieces of information missing for me to form a definitive conclusion. I don't even know what Freeman looked like, or if he had any resemblance to the balding middle-aged man seen in the Datsun on Mateo Road. There are also no details about the student Freeman shot at St. Cuthbert's College. If Freeman had a personal issue with that student, then it's reasonable to assume that the shooting had no connection to Mona's case. It's also worth noting that St. Cuthbert's College is about 4 hours away from where Mona went missing, and I'm not sure if Freeman can be placed in the area on that particular day. If it turns out the lead involving the orange Datsun was completely false, then there really isn't anything to incriminate Freeman, and I'm comfortable believing he was not involved, and that the shooting was an entirely unrelated tragedy which had no bearing on this case. Another individual who has remained on the radar as a possible suspect for decades is Charlie Hughes. He was apparently the only orange Datsun owner in New Zealand at that time who had difficulty providing a concrete alibi and had racked up enough kilometers on the vehicle to suggest he may have taken a long trip on the weekend Mona disappeared. But to his credit, it does appear that Hughes has been cooperative with the investigation, and he even voluntarily provided a DNA sample in 2005, something which guilty people are not prone to do. He has publicly expressed his frustration at being considered a suspect all these years, and does come across as someone who genuinely wants to clear his name. Like John Freeman, I also have no idea what Hughes looks like, and if he might bear a resemblance to the balding man seen in the Datsun on Matea Road. But once again, if it turns out the Datsun was a false lead, that it has no connection to Mona's disappearance, what evidence is there to incriminate Hughes? Even if his alibi is shaky, and the kilometers on the Datsun don't match up with the story, it really doesn't matter that much if the driver of the Datsun wasn't the person who murdered Mona. So I don't feel too strongly about Hughes as a suspect either. However, one person I am fairly certain never should have been a suspect in the first place is the deceased traffic officer, Mervyn Derek Hinton. As you recall, the main reason Hinton showed up on the radar to begin with is because a former police officer and friend named Tony Moeller has spent years gathering evidence against him, and even arranged for an excavation to be done under the laundry room in Hinton's former home. Hinton's daughter, Pauline Barrett, has steadfastly defended her father's innocence, and even maintains a website in which she debunks Tony Moeller's so-called evidence. And I love her URL for it. TonyBaloney.co.nz. Yes, the website is run by someone with a personal stake in the whole thing, but I gotta say, Pauline presents a very convincing case that her father didn't do it. Even though Moeller has tried to claim that Hinton owned an orange Datsun station wagon in 1975, Pauline has always insisted that it was an orange Toyota Corolla station wagon. Moeller countered this claim by providing the name of a man who would supposedly confirm that Hinton owned both a Datsun and a Toyota at that time, and that he arranged for both cars to be repainted shortly after Mona went missing. Well, when questioned, this man apparently had no idea what Moeller was talking about. And Pauline has posted a photograph on her website, dated from 1978, which shows her father's Toyota parked in the family's garage, and it's still orange. And speaking of photos, there are also pictures on the website of the recently completed laundry room Mona was supposedly buried under. The problem is that they're dated May 21st, 1975, 10 days before Mona went missing, so there's no way Hinton could have dug up that laundry room again and buried her without attracting attention. And of course, Hinton does not bear any resemblance to the middle-aged man supposedly seen in the Datsun with Mona on Matea Road. That man was described as balding, but Hinton had a full head of hair until the day he died. It's clear that Tony Moeller has some sort of agenda here, as he's also shared stories about Hinton being violent and physically abusive towards his wife and children, a claim that Pauline feverishly denies. It seems that now that his police career is over, Moeller has become an amateur sleuth who wants to attain the glory of solving one of the most famous cold cases in New Zealand history, but I think he's completely barking up the wrong tree here, and tarnishing the reputation of an innocent man who is no longer around to defend himself. So I feel pretty confident that Hinton was not the perpetrator. The other major lead involving the Orange Dotson was the anonymous letter sent to the police in July of 1975 from a young woman who claimed that she was picked up by a man driving a Dotson who made her uncomfortable on the same day Mona disappeared, and that she later saw the same car parked by the road and caught a partial read on the license number. Since the writer never came forward, no one has any idea if the letter was genuine or a hoax. But I think her story doesn't really match the eyewitness accounts that day. The writer doesn't give an exact location where she was picked up by the Dotson, but makes it sound like it was somewhere on State Highway 5 between Taupo and Napier. But Mona was seen climbing into the Dotson in Taupo, so theoretically, shouldn't she have already been in the car when this woman was picked up? If the driver was the killer, I guess it's possible he could have murdered Mona and disposed of her body before he picked up the letter writer. But again, if the new theory is correct, and the Orange Dotson has no actual connection to this case, then the story in the letter has no real significance. So now we're going to explore this recent theory from investigators about a biker gang, but let's start from the beginning. One thing which seems pretty certain is that Mona did manage to successfully hitchhike from Hamilton to Taupo, which is about the halfway point on her trip to Hastings. We do have multiple witnesses placing her there that morning at around 10 a.m., and the attendant who spoke to Mona at the information center claims she said she was on her way to visit her family in Hastings, so I think that sighting was genuine. But after that, the contradictions begin, as we have a truck driver who said he saw Mona climbing into an Orange Dotson which drove her out of town shortly after 10 o'clock, while other witnesses have placed Mona in Taupo a few hours after that, between 12 o'clock and 1:30. I find it very interesting that it now appears there was a major discrepancy about Mona's appearance, as the photograph which circulated after she vanished showed her with a completely different hairstyle than the one she had on the day she went missing. And there's quite a distinct difference between having long hair with blonde curls and a shorter mullet-style haircut on that particular day. This is one of those details you probably wouldn't even think about in the era of the selfie, where people constantly take up-to-date photographs of themselves. If Mona decided to completely change her hairstyle today, she'd probably post a photo of it on social media within minutes. But in 1975, it's definitely not implausible that no pictures of Mona's current hairstyle existed, and the best photo her family could provide was outdated. The big issue is that this discrepancy might call into question the sighting of Mona climbing into the Orange Dotson, which has been the crux of the entire investigation these past four decades. Because if the truck driver who reported this sighting was basing it off the photograph of Mona which was circulated by the police, then he could have remembered seeing a young woman with long blonde hair climbing into a Dotson. Since that's not the hairstyle Mona had on that particular day, it's possible that he actually saw an entirely different blonde woman. Remember, this was a busy holiday weekend with a lot of traffic in an era where hitchhiking was fairly common, so there could have been a number of young blonde women hitching rides through Taupo that day. Now, we do have another eyewitness sighting which seems to corroborate the truckers, and that's the fencing contractor who saw a young woman and middle-aged man inside an Orange Dotson on Matea Road. It's possible that this was the same woman that the trucker saw climbing into the Dotson in Taupo, but again, if she had long blonde hair rather than a mullet-style cut, then it might not have been Mona. Of course, this sighting took place on a remote dirt road 200 meters from the highway, and when the fencing contractor passed by the vehicle again later on, he said it was empty. So even if Mona was never in that car, where did the man and woman go? I can see why investigators found this sighting to be so credible at the time, as it would be easy to assume that this man had harmed Mona and was off disposing of her body somewhere. I have to say, it would be quite a coincidence if some other young female hitchhiker was being murdered in that remote area on the exact same day Mona disappeared. So unless the fencing contractor completely made up the story, this is the reason I can't completely discount the possibility that Mona was in the Dotson. But now we'll examine the other eyewitness sightings of Mona in Taupo that day, and it doesn't look like they were taken that seriously until new investigators recently took a fresh look at the case. We have one sighting of Mona and another young female hitchhiker climbing into a darkish blue-green station wagon at 10:30 a.m., two sightings of Mona drinking with a young woman at the Spa Hotel sometime between noon and 1:30 p.m., and another one where she was seen climbing into a red Toyota station wagon outside the hotel alone. I have a feeling that not all of these sightings can be accurate, because they depict Mona climbing into two different cars in the same town 3 hours apart, which doesn't make much sense. So it's likely that in at least one or more of these sightings, the witnesses may have seen another young woman who resembled Mona. I might give a bit more credence to the sighting from the fruit shop worker at 10:30, since he knew Mona personally, though it doesn't look like he interacted with her. But even if Mona was sporting a completely different hairstyle than shown on her photograph, there's a decent chance this witness still would have recognized her. She was seen climbing into a vehicle, and it makes more sense for Mona to be leaving town at 10:30, shortly after she arrived. She still had over 150 kilometers to travel to Hastings, and she wanted to arrive at her family's place in time for her nephew's birthday party in order to surprise them. That's the biggest issue I have with the subsequent sightings of Mona at the hotel. Why would she still be hanging out and drinking in Topaz 2 to 3 hours later? But on the other hand, the witness who saw Mona climbing into the red Toyota station wagon claimed he spoke to her, and she told him her name was Mona Blades, so that also lends some credence to this sighting. And there's also the fact that multiple people saw Mona in the company of another young woman, but since it was a busy holiday weekend, it's possible that Mona could have befriended another female hitchhiker and decided to travel with her. Yet we have two different sightings of Mona climbing into two different cars at two different times, and the first time, she's with another woman, and the second time, she's alone. So if Mona really was hanging out with another hitchhiker, what happened to her? It doesn't look like any other young women from the area were reported missing around this time. I know that after the Cold Case TV program aired, the police put out a press release asking any female hitchhikers who were in Topaz that weekend to come forward if they were called seeing or traveling with Mona Blades, but it doesn't look like that's happened yet. It seems like investigators are now leaning towards the theory that Mona was the victim of a biker gang. They've said that Mona had affiliations with biker gangs during that time period, though they've been a bit vague on the details. But one witness has recently come forward who specifically implicated the Highway 61 Motorcycle Club, so I suppose I should provide some backstory about them. The Highway 61 Motorcycle Club is an outlaw biker gang who formed in Auckland in 1968, and they eventually became the largest biker gang in New Zealand. If you look up their history, you'll find no shortage of incidents in which its members have been implicated in violent crimes, such as murder and rape. The Highway 61 gang have chapters in Hastings and Topaz, so Mona could have crossed paths with them both before and when she went missing, especially since one of these gangs was reportedly passing through Topaz to attend a convention in Wellington that same weekend. Now, the connections are pretty tentative. We have the aforementioned witness who claimed that a deceased friend of his once told him he was with members of the Highway 61 gang when they bragged about killing Mona back in 1976, but this is strictly third-hand information. You might be wondering why it took this man so long to come forward with this story, but it sounds like he initially dismissed it because all the media attention focused on Mona being abducted by someone driving an orange Datsun. It was only after the Cold Case program called this lead into question and shifted the focus toward biker gangs that he suddenly thought his friend's story might have some truth to it. But the thread which might link Mona to this gang is the fact that she was seen climbing into a red Toyota station wagon, and a vehicle matching that description was seen with a biker convoy near Topaz that day. And later that night, a witness claimed she saw two men placing a rolled carpet into the back of a red Toyota. These might all be entirely unrelated events which have no significance, but they do allow one to dream up a potential scenario for what happened to Mona. If the driver of the red Toyota had a connection to the biker gang, they could have driven Mona to the bikers to be murdered, and those responsible subsequently used the Toyota to dispose of her dead body. I mentioned earlier that my biggest issue with the sightings of Mona at the Spa Hotel is it sounds like she was anxious to make it to her family's home in Hastings in good time, so why would she still be hanging around in Topa hours after she arrived? Well, the authorities have put forward the idea that Mona may have been murdered by people she knew, so if she happened to bump into some acquaintances in Topa, perhaps they compelled her to hang around with them for a little while. Perhaps this other young woman seen with Mona was someone she knew. And if Mona had previous affiliations with biker gangs, maybe she ran into some bikers she recognized and trusted, but did not realize how violent they really were, so they wound up harming her. This is a fairly plausible theory, and I can see why it was never explored at the time, given how much emphasis was placed on the orange Datsun station wagon. If the new investigators are willing to discredit the primary lead which everyone has stuck to these past 40-plus years, then they must have uncovered some pretty convincing evidence to make them believe this biker gang theory is closer to the truth. It would be pretty heartbreaking if it turned out investigators have been looking in the wrong direction all this time, but at least they're willing to remedy that. Mona's parents have both since passed away, and for the first 3 decades after she went missing, the Blades family almost never did interviews with the media, as they just found the whole experience too painful to relive. They've since become more open about appearing in the spotlight, particularly since the investigation has now started exploring other leads. Personally, I can't say I'm entirely 100% convinced that the lead with the Datsun was false, but so much time has passed that I'm all for looking at the case with fresh new eyes and exploring a different angle. With any luck, this new angle turns out to be the correct one. We've had a number of decades-old cold cases get solved these past few years, so who's to say that couldn't occur again? So if you happen to have any information about the unsolved disappearance of Mona Blades, please contact the appropriate authorities. Anyway, another special thanks to Lo Quinn Britton for doing such a great job at narrating our opening. If you've already entered our monthly contest before, you are automatically eligible for my next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you want to enter and haven't done so yet, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you have a moment, please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've already released some exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and we'll be releasing another new one this month, so to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Ben, Amanda H, Sarah HW, and Hanan SB. And for the last several weeks, I've been expressing thanks to our regular patrons who have been signed up with us for a while, and here are the rest of the folks I haven't gotten to yet. So this week, I'd like to express my appreciation for Carol, Vigard B, Justin S, Aura, Kenda H, Lily Y, James L, The Murder in My Family Podcast, Nikki C, Eman R, Carrie S, Jeff B, Aaron D, Lisa L, Daniel G, John L, Hannah H, Amanda B, Mark M, Reno, David M, Kristen L and T, and Liz Ike S. Thank you all so much for your support. And before we bring this episode to a close, I have a special announcement. One of the cases featured on The Trail Went Cold has just been solved. You might recall an episode back in February where we covered 2 separate cases which took place on Valentine's Day, one of which was the 2007 murder of 39-year-old Jodine Sarin. It was an absolutely horrible crime, as Jodine had mental disabilities, and her parents initially thought that they'd walked in on her having sex with a man in her bedroom. But little did they know that this man had actually strangled Jodine to death, and was violating her dead body before he fled the scene. Well, I'm pleased to announce that last week, DNA evidence finally linked the crime to a suspect named David Mabrito, who committed suicide back in January of 2011. So while Mabrito will never face justice for this crime, and we may never know how he met Jodine and what prompted him to commit such a heinous murder, At least we can take comfort in knowing that he's no longer out there harming others, and that Joe Dean's parents have finally received full closure. So our full condolences to the Sarin family, and hopefully, this will not be the last Trailwind Cold case which winds up being solved. Also, just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. Need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for a brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. ¶¶